Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, I want to talk about a book here called The Key Man. In fact, it's called The Key Man, the true story of how the global elite was duped by a capitalist fairy tale. It's written by two Wall Street Journal reporters. It's an investigation into a man called Arif Navi. He ran a private equity firm called Abrash. He was a financier who spoke alongside Bill Gates at Davos and was even hailed as a potential leader of his native Pakistan. People like Bill Gates, Western governments, other investors, they trusted Arif with billions of dollars. He was seen as the key man for wealthy investors who wanted to make money, while at the same time do good for the less fortunate in the world. However, now he's accused of playing the leading role in a multi-million dollar fraud, and a London judge has approved his extradition to the US, and if found guilty, he faces up to 291 years in jail. He denies all wrongdoing. Well, I'm joined now by Will Lauch, one of the authors of the book, The Key Man, the true story of how the global elite was duped by a capitalist fairy tale. And he joins me now. So good afternoon, Will. Arif, tell me about him. He's the boy from Karachi, Pakistan, and he did what?
So Arif Naqvi was born in Karachi in 1960. He was the son of middle-class parents, educated at probably the most exclusive school in Karachi, which is Karachi Grammar School. From there, he was a top-performing student. He graduated from school and went to the London School of Economics in the fine city of London. There, he studied history under some professors. He graduated and then went to work for an accountancy firm called Arthur Anderson. From Arthur Anderson, he then held jobs working in Pakistan again, American Express, and then he went to work for a very rich Saudi Arabian investment firm called the Alliance Group. Mm. The story really begins when he moves to Dubai in the mid-90s. He there decides to buy a company or a part of a company called Inchcape. In what was the first leverage buyout or private equity deal done in the Middle East. And this basically involves raising money from investors and banks to buy a company. So he did this deal very successfully, made tens of millions of pounds for himself. And then in the early 2000s, 2002, he set up a investment firm called the Abrash Group. Mm. And the Abrash Group is really where...
Exactly, yeah, and that's 2002, so that's 20 years ago. So because of his success, and because of the fact that, I mean, you do say that he was watching the moon landing on TV and was really inspired by that back in 69, then the LSE, then Arthur Anderson, then American Express, and then Dubai, as you say, and he found this Abrash by 2002. So success, 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 he did very well. Did he quickly become a poster boy for stakeholder capitalism and explain stakeholder capitalism if he did?
Yeah, indeed, he did. So his investment firm originally started off just being about making money. So, I mean, private equity firms are notorious amongst various groups of people for being very financially motivated, buying companies, laying off employees, asset stripping, and then selling on these companies for more money, making themselves incredibly wealthy in the process, but maybe not necessarily doing things which are beneficial for society or for workers at the companies they own. So Arif initially started off as just being a pure moneymaker, private equity guy. Mm-hmm. He quickly realized, maybe a decade before it became mainstream in finance, that there's a notion of shareholder, stakeholder capitalism, which basically means that the point of a business or an investment firm is to benefit all of society and do good, as well as making money. Mm. And this is a bit of a step change from the kind of consensus in Western society, and I mean almost globally, since Milton Friedman first came up with the idea of shareholder capitalism in the 70s. Yeah, so Arif basically said, I mean, his pitch to people that gave him money to invest was, give me money to invest and I can make you money, but I can also do good.
Yeah.
By doing good, Arif said that he could improve access to healthcare in countries in which, in Africa and Asia, he could improve access to education in these countries as well.
Yeah, and that's really what it was all about. So, I mean, if you see the big names around him, from Bill Gates to Prince Charles to the Secretary of State John Kerry, he sat on boards at Interpol and the UN. The New York Times would write fantastic things about him. So would Forbes magazine. Glowing profiles, I'll call them. But do you think he saw a gap? You know, he saw Occupy Wall Street doing this. He saw a financial crisis doing that. And that maybe the huge moneyed people were looking for ways that they could show, and I will say show only, that they cared.
I think absolutely. I mean, if you track like the history of impact investing, for instance, I mean, the term was invented pretty much in 2008 at a meeting of the Rockefeller Foundation in, of all places, a beautiful villa in Italy. And so after this term was invented, I mean, people obviously saw what happened with the financial crisis and maybe realized that companies and financial institutions geared solely towards making money. I mean, it didn't always end so well if the pursuit of profit is the sole motivating factor. And so I think after that happened, I mean, people did take a step back and look and think, hey, maybe what's our purpose? So JP Morgan, a huge US investment bank, was heavily involved in research kind of to do with the whole impact investing movement. And this is around 2010, 2011. And if you track where the movement has gone in the last decade alone, I mean, literally every single large financial institution or big corporate company, they all talk about, you know, ESG, impact investing, doing good for society, their shareholders.
Well, hold on. That's the funny thing. You say talk, and that's one of the... I think that could be the word. I mean, like for instance, like there's often a moment when this thing turns completely in the right way. And for Arif, you know, this is probably it, where Barack Obama went to Cairo, great speech, healed healed the US relationship with the Muslim world. So did he note this speech, head off to Washington, and could I say, well, a speech is one thing, and he knew a speech is one thing, but implementation is another, and hey, I'm the one to do it, and invest in business and create jobs and grow the economy. Kind of a Marshall Plan for the Middle East. For the Middle East. Hey, I'm your guy.
I think there was absolutely. He was an opportunist and a strategist. He spent heavily on marketing and sponsoring events at the World Economic Forum in Davos. I mean, he was a fixture there every single year. He was one of its top sponsors, and he built an incredible network across finance, politics. I mean, anyone, the media, anyone who was anyone, pretty much, he knew and had access to. And I think in terms of his credentials for going to the Obama administration and pitching to manage some of their money, I mean, he was from some of the places where he was investing.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, if you look at other efforts to do this, I mean, if you have a white banker from JP Morgan who's based in London saying, hey, give me your money. I mean, Arif had worked in Dubai. He'd worked in Saudi Arabia. He was from Pakistan. He knew these markets a lot better than, you know, a white person in Dublin, New York or London would do.
Of course, yeah. By the way, we are talking about the key man, the true story of how the global elite was duped by a capitalist fairy tale, from Simon Clark. And Will, how do you pronounce your surname, Will? Is it Louch?
Louch.
Yeah. Okay. So let's take a look at this guy then, Arif, the man we're talking about. He was very quickly seen to be the key man. How soon were red flags there? I mean, like, this guy was flying a Gulfstream jet, and you know, he had a personalised tail number on his Gulfstream jet. To me, that's a bit of, seriously, he was sailing on yachts. Sinbad the Sailor is in the book there. He owned a huge estate in Oxford. He gave loads of money to the local cricket team, etc. And he had a lavish dinner when the Pakistani Prime Minister was there at Davos, and it cost, well, you wouldn't get much change out of $500,000. Surely some people would go, seriously? What's this about?
Well, I mean, I think there is that interesting dichotomy between a lot of the people who talk most about, you know, spending philanthropy. I mean, Arif gave very lavishly to charity. I mean, if you look at like some of the leading figures in this, you have Bono, for instance, a rock star. Bill McGlashan was another leading figure in the impact investing movement. He was a private equity guy like Arif, worked for a large US private equity firm called TPG.
Yeah.
A lot of these conversations and a lot of these kind of deals to you know, Aris healthcare, $1 billion healthcare fund that he set up with Bill Gates. All of it's kind of brokered at Davos in expensive hotel rooms, you know, away from the public gaze. I think the fact that he had a private jet, I mean, he would almost be out of place at Davos if he didn't fly in.
Yeah. You have to have certain trappings, I suppose, all right, for people to take you seriously, as well as having the sort of kudos to say, listen, look how good I am. But I mean, like, you know, he did move effortlessly, as you say, amongst the great and the good. And you mentioned Bill Gates, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, even the Pope, for crying out loud. You know, he did know how to handle the great institutions of power. That's government and banks and accountants and companies. And he was very good at it. So, you know, basically these guys were saying, in terms of philanthrocapitalism, as they call it, if you were a chief executive with a conscience, you know, this guy was the man for you, because in that position you're supposed to increase the wealth of shareholders. That's the only reason you're there. But now you can make money and you can help the poor. If you go back to Abraj, as you call it, he's the founder. It's a private equity fund that managed nearly 14 billion. He knew what he was doing with money, didn't he?
He definitely did know what he was doing with money. And he was initially, he had some huge successes. I mean, there was one deal that he did where he bought a bank and he made nearly $1 billion in 1 year, which is quite an exceptional sum of money for any person to make in such a short period of time. So in terms of the firm, and we should add at this point that Arif denies all accusations of wrongdoing, and he, if he faces trial in the US and is extradited, he will plead not guilty. It should be added to that that five other members of Abraj, the senior management team there, have also been indicted by the US Department of Justice, one of whom has pleaded guilty to charges including fraud and racketeering. Abraj has been fined $315 million by the regulators in Dubai. And so we just need to make that clear. That's the kind of legal standpoint.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to get to that in a second or two as to exactly where he is now and what this extradition might mean. Yeah. But before we get to that, you yourselves, I mean, to write this book and to do this expose and to go very deep into the whole thing, you got a tip off as Wall Street Journal people in London, yourself and Simon Clark. So you broke the story of an investigation and then it kind of all unraveled.
What happened was I received an email in January 2018 from someone who said that investors, including Bill Gates, an arm of the UK government, French government, and OPIC, which is a branch of the US government as well, were investigating where hundreds of millions of dollars of their money had gone. So Abraj had raised $1 billion to invest in healthcare facilities, including hospitals and diagnostic clinics in Africa and Asia. They had discovered, I think in September 2017, they had asked Abraj where some of the money had gone. Mm. And it's quite a comical moment, I mean, in the book, where investors on the call say, "Hi, like, where is our money?" And the response from a junior Abraj employee, they said it was held in a certain bank account. A few weeks prior to that, they'd been told it was in a different bank account.
Yeah.
And the investors like, "Hang on a sec. You told us a few weeks ago that it was actually in this bank account. Where is our money?" And the call, obviously, after that, I mean, it was cast off, and the branch like, "We'll get back to you." And then someone, an executive that worked at the Bill Gates Foundation, who played an integral role in, you know, unearthing what was actually going on here, sent an email just saying, "Hi, $225 million of our money is missing. Shouldn't be too hard to find out where it is." Because, I mean, it's not every day that people displace sums of money that substantial.
Yeah.
We found out about it a few months later and published a story on the 2nd of February 2018, noting some of the details of the investigation that the investors had commissioned. After that, all hell really broke loose.
And all hell broke loose because of the work that you did. Was it easy? Were there loads of documents? Did it take a long time?
It was incredibly difficult. So, I mean, to get an article published, so the first article we published in the Wall Street Journal, for instance, was probably 800 words long. But the pain that an investigative journalist has to, or a journalist has to go through to write something which clearly could have very far-reaching implications.
Absolutely.
As six people have been charged by the US Department of Justice. Yeah, so we published front page expose in October that year, so a full 9 months after we got the initial tip-off. And this expose showed that money had been transferred from various funds to personal bank accounts connected with Arif and his family. So, as I said, I mean, that was 9 months between...
But what you have to do here in this book is you have to move across Asia, Africa, Europe, America, and it doesn't even get halfway there with some of the stuff. So is this the story of how the global elite was just simply duped by some sort of a capitalist fairy tale? What I don't get is, like, you know, the company board members, reputable audit firms, best legal advisors, upstanding regulators, the right kind of people, etc. And then how does it happen time and time again that basically, and can I say this, they fail us?
Well, I think it's a great question. I mean, initially, people want to believe good stories. And Arif's story and his pitch was a great story. It's like, give me your money and I can solve many of the world's most pressing problems, like governments are failing us. So, you know, let the private individual take over, the private company take over. And I mean, it was a very seductive message that a lot of people fell for. It's attractive if someone says, you know, give me your money and I'll double it in a few years. If someone's saying, give me your money, I'll double it in a few years, and also, you know, mean that people in Africa now have affordable healthcare when before they didn't have that or access to that. I mean, it is a very intoxicating message. And yeah, I mean, as you say, I mean, you have Jordan Belfort, like the Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, the Wolf of Wall Street, same thing,
Exactly the same thing. But yeah, I mean, Arif was different because he said that he could do good as well as just purely making money.
Was there a turning point for him where things went wrong in his own head?
It's not up to us as journalists and as the co-author of this book, I think, to get inside his head. I think it's up for the reader to really work out, you know, whether he was out to do good and went wrong, or whether he was out for himself all along. I mean, it's difficult for us to really say. I think it is really up to the reader to make up their own mind on that point. But it's something that we always get asked, and it's a very difficult question to answer because it's so difficult to tell. But I think people do, generally speaking, get used to a certain level of living and of power and of influence.
And there's no doubt about it that he definitely wanted to continue to fund that.
If you lose the power and influence that you once had, then it's a very difficult thing to do.
And here in this story, the firm collapsed with up to $500 million nearly missing or whatever. And he was arrested at Heathrow. He's out on $19 million bail, and he has to wear an ankle bracelet because clearly he's a flight risk.
They were arguments that were made in court. I think that was why the judge set his bail so high. I mean, because the prosecuting team argued that he was a significant flight risk because he had access to potentially lots of capital, which will facilitate an escape.
Okay, so Arif is now in South Kensington. He's awaiting extradition. You mentioned earlier on, I was going to ask to where, but that's to the US. So, and he denies wrongdoing, of course. But just as a matter of interest, is he living in luxury as we speak?
So I have been to his apartment. I wasn't allowed inside, but I knocked on the door. The apartment is in South Kensington, which is a very, very nice place to live.
The Key Man is what it's called. The true story of how the global elite was duped by a capitalist fairy tale. And it's out now from Simon Clark and Will Louch. And Will, thank you so much for joining us on the programme today.
Thank you very much for your time and interest in the book. Dave Fanning, Weekends on 2FM.